You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another Damn Fine Cup of Culture. For this, our Halloween episode, we are looking once again at horror, or rather, the horror. Films that scare with the definite article. And joining me to discuss the horror are the Sam.
Hey, the Alan.
And the Julie.
Hello, the three of us.
So we've each brought a film to the table, which is very much a horror striking title that is the definitive article plus the thing that we're going to scare about. I think we're going to start, Sam. You brought The Omen to the table. Is this one of your favourite horror films, or what was your reason for picking it?
Well, the reason for picking it, I think, because as usual, it's one of the earliest such horror film I saw, taping it somewhere in the 1990s. It was often late on television, and then watching it is one of those slightly forbidden too early to watch movies. So they placed it at like 11 o'clock or midnight. But then, of course, I saw it and I really liked the atmosphere. I remember it has this like mid-70s feel, the scare that parents apparently had about their children back then. And it was wonderfully cast with a very weighty Gregory Peck in it and a great supporting cast, you know, Billy Whitelaw, David Warner, people that I would see in many other roles afterwards or had already seen. And it had this fantastic Jerry Goldsmith score, obviously. So I was listening to like Ave Satani and the score, you know, like endlessly, much to the chagrin of my mother, who thought that was lost to Satanism, probably. And so it became this cult film for me, music and mood and just the, you know, the shock value of those very memorable scenes, decapitations and impalings and hangings. And I mean, it was kind of like a first ultimate encounter with this kind of sensationalist 70s horror that would follow it up with lots of other horror films of the 70s, the 80s. Afterwards, it became kind of one of my, you know, strangely my most enjoyable genre, just seeing all these horror films and seeing what the fuss was all about. So The Omen stands very tall at the beginning of this process. My love for horror film up to this day, I find it such an interesting genre in general. And The Omen is, yeah, my initiation in a way.
It's a true classic, isn't it, Sam? I watched it again recently, just for the podcast here. And it was a great deal of fun, but it gets a little bit dated, doesn't it?
It certainly does. You know, I think it is really stuck in that 70s mood and probably that moment in time where they discovered that after The Exorcist, especially, that there was like so much to exploit in terms of like fears of families, of parents, the children that after the late 60s, I guess, could be out of control and out of bounds. I think there's a certain, you know, uncertainty in that period of cinema after Vietnam, Watergate, the late 60s, where I feel that seeps into this sensationalism of these films, right? You're scaring people in their very home that evil could be lurking, you know, within their families. And it could be that child that is not really your child. There could be a deep evil force behind it. So I think that's fascinating, but also very timely about The Omen. I think that's why remakes and sequels kind of got stuck in that same mode, and it really didn't add anything to it since.
No, I don't think so either. And I mean, for modern audiences, I guess it's a bit slow, isn't it? I mean, it has this drama sort of pace with lots of atmosphere and threatening skies and things, and I'm not sure whether it's pacey enough just to keep the attention of a modern audience. But if you sit down for it, there's a great deal to enjoy. As you say, this decapitation, which I'm a bad person. That should not make me laugh because it's a, you know, but it's so over the top. It's so hard to take seriously somehow, even though it's a really sympathetic character and we got to know them through the film. And now suddenly, by an act of Satan, he gets decapitated by a glass pane. What can you do? And I have quite a bit of trouble putting any weight to that. I mean, I'm not sure whether I would have children watch this. It's a little, maybe a little bit hefty, but I've seen much, much worse.
Yeah, I think there's some, you know, in a weird way, there's some entertainment value to that, right? Everybody who's seen the film remembers this decapitation scene, maybe also the impaling. So I think what's really great about it is that you can share this experience of seeing these scenes. But yeah, the bits in between are fairly slow, and it is a family picture in a way that builds slowly and then gets more political and has all kinds of like side characters step in. But I do think that you remember the general mood of the film, especially with, you know, Billy Whitelaw as Mrs. Baylock coming into the house and becoming this lurking threat. I think she's a great character in there.
She's lovely with the dogs and everything. I mean, she's like, this film was obviously satirized by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman in Good Omens.
Yeah, of course.
Quite a bit, which made it to the screen, but that's the sideline. But again, the nanny and the dogs and the hellhound, whatever it is. I mean, again, I love this thing. It's a true classic, but I wonder whether... I think it's a bit hard to take seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I have a soft spot for it, clearly. You know, it's something that I can rewatch endlessly and just go back into that time when I really loved it. But of course, watching it with other people these days, they certainly see the flaws in it and maybe a little bit the pacing problem. And I think, you know, there was recently the first Omen, kind of the prequel that tells the story of up until the point where Gregory Peck and Lee Remick then take on this child from Rome. And that had a couple of interesting new additions to it. You know, it kind of went back into that 60s Italy period with one girl trying to become a nun at the beginning of the film. And she's the protagonist then. And it tells the story up until this point where the Omen starts. And I felt, okay, if you take it as a, you know, point in time of a certain period and you make it about different characters and not always about this family and about Damien as the main character, which doesn't really terribly work well in the sequels either, then I think there's a little bit to add. But again, of course, you have to provide the shock value. You have to have the hangings, the decapitations, and the impalings, or much worse, in order to make it work. That seems to, you know, like Final Destination. It became a trope in every Omen movie. You had to have these terrible deaths. And I think it's kind of, yeah, a prelude to what we saw in the 90s or 80s Scuzzy horror, Alan, but you have to tell me if the Omen is a prelude to that.
I mean, I definitely think Final Destination, if you're sort of rewatching the Omen now, you suddenly see that sort of vibe come along, the sort of idea that the universe somehow is conspiring to kill someone. As an idea, I think it comes from the Omen. The terror is that an accident isn't an accident. And we all know watching that it isn't an accident, but no one's going to believe it. And I think that still works. I think that's such an incredible idea that I do remember when I was young, my first experience of the Omen was the playground talk that the people who had seen it when they shouldn't have seen it. And all of that revolved around the deaths. All of it was, you know, there's these really cool ways that people die in accidents, but the devil's caused it. And that sort of, yeah, it's slightly scuzzy excitement, I think, does carry through the film. I do think it helps it work that they do take it seriously. The sort of very serious acting, the very tone of it being so earnest is what makes it work. I also think it's what makes the best bits of the Final Destination films work, is when they make the people seem more real than just, here's 10 beautiful young actors we're going to kill. The more they make you involved in that their lives have a reality to it, then the horribleness is so much more fun. And there's something in the Omen that people turn up and they're like Patrick Troughton and David Warner and these great British actors that are giving it all, who really take it seriously. And you can just imagine the moment the cameras stopped working, they were all like, what is this silliness? You know, we're just making this some daft. And you've already mentioned the new nanny that comes along, this brilliant performance. And it's about nonsense. And there's something wonderful about taking scary nonsense seriously like this. And I think The Omen, the 70s did this a lot. And I think The Omen is my favorite example of it.
Yeah, in that sense, it's also very, very influential. I mean, you can call it a classic or a cult film, but it's an incredibly influential film. I mean, we tend to forget that The Omen is basically everywhere in horror.
Yeah, and at the same time, they had so many, you know, films about the kids that might be evil around that time. I mentioned before, the late 60s, so Rosemary's Baby is probably the first such example that The Exorcist comes, and The Omen seems to be the one that, you know, is the least maybe novel in terms of the filmmaking. It more exploits the fact that it's a great moment to get on the bandwagon of evil children. But it does it so like solidly and with such a good cast. And like you said, with so much gravitas. I was think of Gregory Peck. It was probably one of the first movies I ever saw him in. And I really, really liked his performance. I just knew that he was, you know, my grandmother's heartthrob, and she would go on endlessly about beautiful Gregory Peck. But he was really good in this. And one thing I noticed is also part of the atmosphere, even though I liked the English original as well, was the German dubbing that I saw, the video version, the slightly worse quality of the film. And the voices in German is still my favorite version of the film. You know, I have it now in a beautiful, you know, DVD box set and everything, but it never reached the kind of grainy, dark, you know, they couldn't quite see what was going on, plus these voices. And so for me, it's also an example of that. I'm not sure if we talked about this before, but yeah, there was a phase where actually dubbing was really, really good. And the 70s were certainly among the high points of, you know, German actors really getting into these roles and having these signature voices like Sean Connery or Paul Newman having the kind of same voice. So that was from that period.
Oh, wow. Now I have to see it again, but in German.
Do so. Yeah, it is a different, I mean, tell me, but I find it to be quite a different experience atmosphere wise.
Yeah, I do wonder whether it might be worth sort of watching several of these films in different languages and just see if the dubbing then allows for a different approach and whether anyone dubs it and doesn't take it seriously, whether there's a comedy dubbing out there somewhere. I was just going to say, because I think it's another thing that works really well in The Omen, is it does play on that 70s idea of the creepy kid, but it's the most perfect example where the kid is creepy without ever being creepy. Like the child itself just seems like a child. It doesn't make them, it's not like The Exorcist where the child is put through all sorts of hell to show how horrible it is. It's not sort of shot in a way, oh, the kid is now, you know, having a very creepy Village of the Damned like inhuman behavior. The kid mostly just behaves like a kid, just seems quite happy. All the horror is around it. And what's sort of unsettling is this idea that, yeah, this kid just looks normal. And yet it has the potential to be so terrible that you can't see it. You can't see that this is an evil child. But that potential is there, that then the adults are all swimming around to protect. And I think it's so interesting to watch it. And it avoids, I think, the cliches of making the child overtly a horror film evil child, which would have been so easy to do until the sort of very end, really, the final shot. There's no take in the way the child acts that makes you think this is obviously the child of Satan.
No, because it's also, I think it's a very sort of, it's a bit of a classic tale. We have the Antichrist and the end of the world and the apocalypse and so on. And the child themselves don't particularly, they're not actively participating in bringing about the end of the world. The whole idea is that they are the sort of center of a storm around them, like the nanny and the hellhound, and that is supposed to bring about the end of days, right? So the child, I think it would have been a mistake to make the child overtly creepy, because he's not the point. The point is that Satan and God are going to have a slugfest and the world's going to end, and all of the universe is geared towards anybody standing in the way of that dying horribly, suddenly, and without any rhyme or reason. I think in that sense, it's sort of very, it's almost old-fashioned, not in the 70s sense, but an old-fashioned sort of very linear tale. People are going to try and stop the apocalypse. They can't. End of story, right?
And again, it helps that there's a great cast around, you know, people who take this seriously and, you know, have this, these serious faces and the frowns and the little sayings they have about the apocalypse and, you know, these horrible deaths. I think everything, yeah, circles around. And if the filmmaking was worse or if the acting was worse, that the whole thing would fall flat. And you can see that in the sequels, you know, actors got a little bit less prolific in the part two and part three, and they brought in Mia Farrow as Mrs. Baylock for the remake. And, you know, they tried all kinds of things to make it work again. But I think the kind of alchemy of the original Omen never quite got there yet. And I think it makes a difference that the child is that kind of child and it is a small child. For me, the Omen never worked later on because he became a teenager, and then it was Sam Neill as a grown-up in part three. And it just didn't work together with the other lack of production quality, you know. There's a certain magic or alchemy, if you want to call it, in a horror sense or in a fantasy horror sense that worked for 76.
I mean, I think I really like Julie's expression that, you know, Damien's this eye of the storm, but the horror and the drama is just revolving around him. And I think the films do get weaker when Damien sort of is kind of moved to be a main character in the action. At that point, I think it weakens. It doesn't have a strong enough horror formula. And I find the third film especially just incredibly disappointing. I mean, it's almost pious and lecturing in a weird way. But I think the first film has this sort of really simple concept that the devil will protect this innocent child by killing people and by plotting. And I'm just watching that unfold is an incredibly satisfying cinematic experience. And when they try and get involved in the story, the mythology of it, okay, the kid's the son of Satan. How are we now going to tell a tale with the son of Satan? It just becomes much less interesting. It becomes focused on this mythology. It becomes focused on the idea, well, this is good versus evil. Do we really want evil to win? We'll chicken out from that a little bit. And none of that matters with the first film. The first film is, you know, we've got this really good idea. Let's just execute it in as fun and nasty way as possible.
Yeah, and keep it simple, you know. It's what you say. I think if you start complicating this very sort of simple plot line, I think it muddies the waters. I don't think it's necessary. And I think the effectiveness of The Omen is just to have a really good cast, doing a really good job, doing it completely po-faced, and just get it from the beginning to the end. Hellhounds, impalements, and glass panes and all. And that just works. You know, you don't have to make a lot of faff around it.
Well, small shout out to Damien Omen too, however, because it got some elements right. You know, there's William Holden, Lee Grant, Sylvia Sidney. And I think that the person that really makes The Omen work, again, is Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, he composed better and better music for parts two and three. It's kind of among fans, they say, you know, the only thing that got better in The Omen trilogy was like Jerry Goldsmith's music. So he took it really, really seriously and evolved the whole theme and world of this, you know, evil child growing up. So I think it's much to his credit that even the sequels are partly enjoyable, but it certainly adds a lot to the original to have such a, you know, his only Oscar-winning score in there, even though it's flashy and it's loud and it's intense, but it really adds massively to the experience.
Yeah, no, and I think it's quite, I did watch the first Omen not too long ago, and it's sort of quite interesting that it is, that film, I think, understands The Omen and is trying to get the same lightning in a bottle, is sort of trying to, we're going to take this very seriously, we're not going to overcomplicate things, we're just going to have people dying horribly. But I think it just doesn't quite come together. Its heart feels in the right place, which I'm not sure I'd say about Omen 3. But it isn't quite there. And it's quite fun watching characters that you know are going to die in The Omen. So they feel quite safe in this film. But then, but like whatever they achieve in this film, you know, well, this is not going to go anywhere because in the next film, it all goes wrong.
Yeah, but that, I think that sort of, it's all, what I always loved about the Freddy Krueger, the first one, right? The Nightmare on Elm Street, is there is a sort of fun to, how are they going to dispatch of, you know, Johnny Depp in this case? That's the fun of the Final Fantasy thing, right? Is how on earth are they going to manage to write this in, that they dispatch of this character in a spectacular way when they're basically hiding in a cave in the middle of nowhere? It sounds really heartless, but there's a bit of fun to be had to go like, so what will happen? You know, it's, I think it's more interesting in sort of the quote unquote original than it is later, because there is a bit of determinism in its plot and a bit of determinism in the film itself that makes all the surrounding films just less interesting for me, because it can only go one way, right?
And I think sort of the best horror films, they have a nice, simple ending. So they often have an ending that is almost a cliffhanger, or always is, you're not quite sure if everything's great or things aren't great. And I think The Omen can deliver on that. The Omen can deliver a sort of ending that is both satisfying as an ending, but doesn't sort of cheapen the horror. And I think later on, because they're getting sort of so involved in the plot and they kind of have to decide what are we going to do? Are we going to have God or the devil win? That, in horror terms, is just not an interesting plot in a weird way. So, yeah, you stick with the basic idea and tell that well. And I do think that's a good beginning to make a good horror film. It's not guaranteed it's going to work, but I think if you've got that starting point, it really helps.
Yeah, and that cliffhanger of, you know, does Gregory Peck make it or not at the end is riveting.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very riveting thing to have at the end of a movie.
Very effective, yeah.
But I think it's quite interesting that we've mentioned there is this sort of cliche, I guess, nowadays of the child in horror films, of the sort of creepy child. I think a lot often the time there's an assumption that that's all they need. Just put a creepy child. We don't need a story. We don't need a plot. And I think I want to bring in the film that you brought to the table, Julie, which was the Spanish film The Orphanage. I'm not sure I'm going to dare pronounce its Spanish title. I'll get it horribly wrong. Because I think what really is striking about this that I found is it has a story. It has a really engaging story. Rather than just, we've got the creepy kid makeup, we're going to have some jump scares with a creepy kid, that's your film. It's a really interesting story. So yeah, no, what was your reason for bringing this film to the table?
I've always had a soft spot for these quote-unquote foreign language horror films. A little bit, you know, left of center maybe, not that well known, not that hypey. That's something that always interested me. And The Orphanage in 2007 was one that stood out to me because it's a very simple film. It's not very effects heavy. It's not like very flashy. It's almost elegiac in tone. And it sort of adheres more to the ghost story type of filming than to an actual sort of Freddy Krueger's going to get you in your sleep type deal, right? It's not a slasher. And I thought it was produced, I think, partly by Guillermo del Toro, who was asked to finance the film to get it produced. And it was a bit of a success in, you know, it had an ovation when it was screened. People really liked it. Ray the Creepy Kid. It got a bit of criticism that there is a kid in a mask in there, in a cloth mask, like a sack. And there was a little bit of criticism there that, you know, is that all there is to it? And isn't that a bit cheap? And you know, also we're talking about special needs kids. Isn't there an angle there that you have to be really careful because it's sensitive? Personally, I can see that, but I don't follow that kind of criticism. I think it's a ghost story. That is basically what it is. And the creepy kid, quote unquote, is not, he's difficult. He's been adopted. He's having issues. They've moved into a big, creepy house. He has imaginary friends. This kid, he's not a scary kid. He has issues. What is scary is the moment where the mother gets into his ghost world, into his little imaginary friends, gets swallowed up in a way by this ghostly house that she used to live in when she was an orphan herself. And there's a mystery there. And that spoke to me. Look, I love my haute tension, kill them with a chainsaw, hack them all to pieces, slashers. I've written about this before. Give me the giallo, decapitate the lot. But I also sort of appreciate very much that someone puts a lot of energy into making a story about a mother who has to deal with a past that she really doesn't want to acknowledge. A past of her country, a past of this house, what happened there, what happened to her co-orphans that lived there. There's this big silence at the center of the film, and the kid is not so much creepy as he is the embodiment of that. If you're a small kid and you're a troubled kid, how do you deal with being at the center of your own universe? And what's the damage of that? And of course, the plot is very straight. We don't know if she goes insane or not, or if there really are ghosts or not. And then there's an ending, which I won't spoil for you because it really is rather beautiful, you ask me. There's a lot of Peter Pan to it, but there is also an undertone, and I think I can spoil that, about what happened to the children that were there in her time, in the mother's time, because there is a tangent that the film does not end up going in, but that has a lot to do with the past and the past of Spain. So that was a bit cryptic, but I don't want to spoil too much, but then I want to talk about it on the other hand. What did you think?
I know, I understand what you mean about that, especially because, like, when you sort of said it's a ghost story, there needs to be an emphasis on story here. It is telling a story, and the sort of twists and turns as the sort of plot unfolds following that as you watch it is what is this film's real strength. And so you don't want to sort of say, oh, well, obviously it's this reason, because then that might lessen someone who's not seen the film. I think one thing I will say, which is like a minor spoiler, that I think this film does really well is, yes, we've got almost a cliche of the ghost child in a mask, or even you might even say the sort of the disfigured child in a mask. You've got this cliche, which starts out as being, well, that's the threat. It plays like a horror film where that's the creepy, dangerous thing that's going to encroach on the life of this, you know, ordinary mother who's just trying to build her life in a new house. And even the characters make that assumption. So even the characters, I think, are a little bit, this is linked to, well, you know, something terrible is happening here. And then as the story unfolds, you learn that there's so much more to that. And it's actually, rather than being a film where, you know, every 10 minutes, oh no, it's creepy kid come to do something awful again. Every 10 minutes, it's like a plot development. It's something that enriches this whole story, this whole what is actually going on here. And yeah, you don't want to spoil what those stages are as you sort of follow them, and you know, there's tragedy in that, there's darkness in that, but I think it's also a little bit, it's not a film without hope as well. So I think all these aspects that the story then has as it unfolds, you don't want to spoil that, because that is essential to the journey.
And we also have creepy nanny. We have creepy nanny in this one as yes. Well.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, there are some elements of, you know, the worried parents about their child, obviously the fate of their child. I mean, a certain like deep sentiment and maybe also a fear that both the omen and the orphanage strike is, you know, what is at the heart of my child? Like, what's wrong with it? What happened to it? And how can we save it? How do we have that power to, you know, get them back or to release them from evil spirits or even evil possession or this past of this house that is encroaching on the characters? I thought there was also a deep sadness about it. It reminded me most of all of The Others, you know, the Nicole Kidman film of the early 2000s.
Oh, we're very much so. Also a very good film, by the way.
Yeah, I was, you know, when I was watching The Orphanage, I thought, oh, actually, I could have also suggested The Others, because I really loved it when I saw it at the cinema even a couple of times. So also this, you know, there is the sense of that there's so much like buried beneath the ghost surface, that it's not about necessarily the house. It's not about the children that you see at the beginning directly, but it has a lot to do with all these connections of the family, that the protagonist, especially the mother here in that case, to that past. And then also, you know, inhabiting that space of the house. I really love that theme, and also other films like The Changeling or again The Others, where a house is so central to how you feel. And I think the threat is external, when in fact then it's a lot about internal trauma or trauma of the past coming back to haunt these characters. And I love how the film kind of blurs the lines, you know, where you're not quite sure, like you said, is the mother, you know, losing her mind? Is that really happening? Is only she seeing it, or others seeing it? Even the flashbacks to the past, you know, it was very unsettling, and it puts you off kilter in a very interesting way, but doesn't lose the sense that this is about, you know, emotions and a deep sense of sadness. I felt sad for most of the film. Also, the atmosphere of the house and the staff that you see from the past and in the present, there's, you know, there's horror, but there's also tragedy that you feel that comes out really well.
I want to do a content warning for this film before we move on, because I want everybody to see it. But for the parents that may be listening to this, I usually only give content warnings when people's heads get chopped off. But there is a plot twist towards the end of the film, which I'm not going to reveal here, but that is very hard to take even for me. So, you know, be warned that it may not be the heaviest of horrors in terms of effects and in terms of the death that happened, but one of the deaths that does happen is going to break your heart. So go see it, but be warned that this is not an easy story in that sense.
I mean, I think the sort of word that's already been used is this notion of trauma and the sort of history, the trauma in the history. And I do think it's interesting that, like you said, Julie, this was made in post-Franco Spain. And it very much is sort of a society based a little bit on, like, let's not look back. Let's not look at what must have happened in this period.
Yeah, it's a kind of denial, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of captured in this film, the idea that, you know, there is something so dangerous in the past that let's not mess with it. And it doesn't shortchange the idea that if you find out what happened, there is going to be regret and guilt on a traumatic level. And so I think there's, you know, it is something that when it's presented in the film is so striking and quite unique that this is something the characters are going to have to deal with. And dealing with it is a really interesting insight into grief, regret, sort of like what could have been done. And I do, yeah, it is interesting that this has been made in a society that, you know, a generation earlier was still basically run by a dictator. And, you know, there's, I know sort of post-World Germany, they sort of had a thing that like, don't ask anyone over 30 what they did because no one mentions it. But I don't think Germany sort of built the film industry that was going to explore that. But I think Spain did. I think in Spain, there was a bit more openness that like, let's sort of look at that or let's just use this to feed storytelling. And I think that's definitely feels like a part of this film that the darkness of the past has probably been informed by the recent history of Spain.
And the comparison, of course, to Pan's Labyrinth. I think we talked about it in preparation for this podcast as well. Del Toro helping to produce this film, obviously it stands in line with what Pan's Labyrinth did much more directly and openly, is to link the horrors of Spain's past to the horror and the dark, dark fantasy world of Pan's Labyrinth, which is also imbued with this film mostly made me sad. It's one of the horror films that I really cried about, you know, was Pan's Labyrinth. There's such a heaviness and sadness about it. And I felt The Orphanage kind of had a similar feel. It didn't go into the same direction. It obviously didn't open up this, you know, absurdly horrific fantasy below the surface world in the same way as Pan's Labyrinth did. And it wasn't as openly political, but it was in the same tradition, I felt.
Yeah, the imaginary friends and the hiding from reality and the retreat from reality and, you know, the denial, as Alan rightly puts it. But I think why I chose this one and not one of the, you mentioned Pan's Labyrinth, I will also mention later The Devil's Backbone, which is one of my perennial favorites in the genre. What this does is give you an out. It has this very Peter Pan-like sort of through line where it gives you an out that The Devil's Backbone does not give you. So again, I'm not one of these people who think that it's somehow a cop-out, the ending is a cop-out, or that it somehow shirks the reality of the past in any way. But it is a little bit more, it's a little easier to take in that sense than, for instance, Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth might make me cry. The Devil's Backbone just ruins my night, man.
But I do wonder also, the difference is that I think The Orphanage, to some extent, might not even be that consciously trying to make a point about Spain's past.
No, exactly.
It is almost the inevitable consequence if you have people who grew up under a regime like this, that then when they're adults and they want to make a story that looks back at childhood, that looks back at sort of regret, at stuff that isn't spoken, the real world is informing how they're telling the story effectively.
Yes.
But the story itself stands on its own. I think it's a very sort of effective story. And I almost wouldn't say it gives you an out. I think the ending is earned by the story. I think it really fits what they're trying to do. And I do sort of wonder, is it's just one of those things that they're almost not making a film that's commenting on Franco, but you can't help if you've lived it.
It's unavoidable.
Yeah, I think I read that about a sort of Korean director where he basically said, well, this isn't a film made about the fact the Korean sort of, you know, the government, the authoritarian government of the 80s, wasn't a film about that. Or I didn't think I was making a film about that. And then he said he watched it many years later, he watched it back and he said, well, of course it was. You know, you don't have to be sort of being deliberate. And I think it informs this film, but I think this film has its own standalone story that is really satisfying.
Well, it's intrinsic in the sense, why is there an orphanage to begin with? It's called The Orphanage. It's about a woman moving into the orphanage that she grew up in herself in order to make it into a facility for special needs children out of her sort of wish to give something back to the world. There is an orphanage there for a reason, because people were dead. It's intrinsic to the entire existence of this movie that there is a past that's going to creep in through the cracks, whether you want it or not. It's going to be there. But they do have a tangent where they do address that directly. Again, another bit of a heartbreaker. So they're not avoiding it. But the movie itself has such a Peter Pan-esque ghost story type atmosphere that the big heartbreaker that I spoke of previously, the plot twist, doesn't hit as hard as it could have done had this been handled less delicately.
I think there's one thing I would say is that it is such a universal heartbreaker. It's such a universal gut punch. Some of that towards the end, that I think that has a quality to it that anyone, especially anyone I think who's an adult watching it, is going to be affected by that. It doesn't need to be sort of informed by the sort of particulars of a Spanish background. That is a just completely human moment.
And the personal tragedy works, you know, in the film. I think that's, I mean, similar to The Omen, you need good actors to carry the basic core tragedy, which is about parents and a child. And I think both the child actor and especially the mother, I thought, are very effective at carrying that. And, you know, this very unique child, it's not a cliche child. Maybe, you know, Damien, as you said before, also works because she's a normal child. This is not a normal child. Like you said, it's the Peter Pan. It has its quirks. It has its difficulties. And I think the mother struggling to, you know, cope with that child and then maybe scolding it too much and then feeling guilty about this when the child disappears and so on. I think these things are also carried, and the core thing in horror, I always find, is, especially if it's about families, does the family unit work? Do you actually care about them and then what happens to them? Maybe the political dimension or the brutality dimension, especially in The Omen. But here, I think it adds to this overall effect if you can go out from something like a nucleus that does tick, that moves you, that works.
And Belén Rueda, who is the actress, main character, the mother, is exquisite in this. I cannot praise her enough in this because the whole movie leans on her. She has to shoulder this entire thing. Her husband, the actor's name is Fernando Caio, he is the scientist, the doctor, he is the rational actor for her to play against. He's not, that's also been a criticism of the film, that he's quite flat. I think that's the other way around. I think Rueda has to carry the entire film and everything else except the kid. She has to be able to play off of. There's some fantastic acting in there, but she really nails this role.
Yeah, no, I think like I wouldn't call the husband an antagonist at that point, but he has a function in the story rather than it being his story. So there's definitely something. I think in contrast with The Omen, where I think you have lots of great actors playing really solid two-dimensional types that fit this plot, I think what you have here is you have the lead that is a very, very important, very rich role, very sort of multi-layered, that requires a proper actor's performance. Whereas I think some of the other characters that sort of surround her, they kind of are a bit more omen-y. They're a bit more two-dimensional because they have to be. They exist to put her in the situations that the ghost story requires. And I think they do the job really well. And I think, you know, once you accept it's not their story, they don't have to be more detailed. They can perform the function like the lead in The Omen. But I think her performance is incredible because it is her story and she has the sort of emotional range to pull it off. She is the one that has to, throughout the film, is making decisions, is trying to work stuff out, getting things wrong, making mistakes. All of that is, I think, you know, the heart of the film's success.
Yeah, there's a medium in there who is a great deal of fun. She's just this side of ham. Maybe not entirely this side, maybe the other side of ham.
Well, like I said, they perform a function. They are the sort of characters you get in The Omen. They're two-dimensional. They're well-drawn two-dimensional characters who exist to perform a function in this film. And they do it really well. They perform really well. And yeah, no, the medium and almost like the ghost hunter side of things, these like pseudoscientists, that's like a great...
And a creepy nanny as well,
creepy,
you know?
Nannies. I mean, it's a win.
The creepy nanny... But like, just like in The Others as well, I think Nicole Kidman has a similar function in that film, right? The film relies heavily on her, even though there are the children, there are also side characters. But I think it also serves the function of course, drawing us deeply into her perspective. I think in both films, her perspective and not quite being sure whether you can trust her experiences or if it's reality.
Well, it's an unreliable narrator.
Exactly. So that also reminded me a lot of The Others.
I think even in The Orphanage, you know, she's in a way unreliable because she can't trust herself. Is she going bonkers here? And I think she doesn't know. It doesn't make her unreliable in the sense that her experiences are not real or somehow subjectivized. I mean, she's always seen as the objective center of the story. But there's an unreliability there that you also have in the others, where what are we seeing really through her eyes? What is it that we're looking at? And that's part of the fascination of both films and this one in particular. I thought it was such a lovely little film. And it's not often mentioned. I mean, you often go to the big Del Toro ones. But it's a little bit of a gem, I think, in the genre.
Yeah, and I think the real strength, I think, is that it does have this really interesting, at times subtle story that it's telling. And the story has a richness that isn't that common in horror. And I think in direct contrast to that, we could move to the film that I saw brought to the table. So I bought John Carpenter's The Thing. Because I very much felt that it's a very simple story. And I think one of the things, especially with The Omen and some of the other films we were sort of considering for this, is there is something about the as a title that if you get that right, it's a simple concept, run with it. And I think The Thing is probably the best example of this. They had this very simple concept of this sort of alien that can replicate human beings and is out to get you. And you've got men in an ice base, practically under siege, not knowing who they can trust. It's such a simple idea, and they just run with it. And there's not really a story to speak of compared to the previous one. It is just a set of incidences as this like horrible thing unravels. And obviously somebody making the film thought, you know what would be really cool now if this happens that looks horrible? And then you see that in the film, and it has this sort of quality of... They obviously, I think, had a huge amount of fun making it. And that translates into a horror film that's a great deal of fun.
It is a lot of fun, but it is also a little bit more than silly, isn't it? Because there's a bit of body snatching going on and everybody's very po-faced. But this is another one. We spoke about this. We addressed this about The Omen earlier, is that some of these really horrible incidents just make me laugh out of a sort of, because it's just so out there, the out there-ness of it.
I think it's Stan Winston, right, who was responsible for the most of the special effects, right? These creature practical effects morphing from one to the other. And I think, I mean, it's fantastic stuff. It's just like 82 must have been the moment where this was, you know, The Howling was out and all these films that were using these morphing effects that were really done for real without computers yet. And I think it's such a great example of these effects at the height of their power. But of course, they still make you laugh, right? When there's the head on the thing and the morph from the dog and the person. And I mean, they're still shocking. They're still, you see the shock value of them.
I just had to quickly Google because it's Rob Bottin that did the special effects, but he's of that generation of like, yeah. And I think there's a real feeling of like, you get the impression that he would have come to John Carpenter and said, this is something really cool I can do. And they were like, yeah, put it in there. Put that visual in there. Put that like icky moment in there. Because if you can make it work on screen, we should be putting it up on screen. And there's that sort of real spirit to this film that I think is just like really entertaining.
It's adventurous, isn't it, in that way, with the physical effects and it has this bit of sandbox feel to it, like, oh, that would be really cool. Can you make that, you know, whatever. I think the fun in this film is more meta. I mean, it's not satire or anything. It's not like They Live, where it's half satire, political satire. But there's this adventurousness in this where, you know, let's try that. That would be cool.
Well, strangely enough, you know, when I thought of The Thing, I hadn't seen it in a while. The thing that I remember was always, again, the opening, the atmosphere, the setting. It's one of my favorite settings for a horror sci-fi film is this beginning, the dog running towards the station and the helicopter chasing it. And then the setup of, you know, who's there and what are their kind of work-like connections. They're not really close to each other, right? You don't really care about the characters. Maybe Kurt Russell, because he is well-known. But just this opening, this, you know, they're stuck there, then this dog comes and there's something wrong with it. You can sense that. There's a certain, of course, an alien feel to it. But then it does something very different than Alien does, right? Alien kind of conceals the monster and builds this kind of, you know, one person after the other gets killed off in a very different way. Here, it's almost like, you know, they're trying to top each of the practical effects with another one, and then it turns like absurd at one point. It's not scary. I mean, it's atmospheric, and the Morricone / Carpenter music plays well into it. But by the middle of the film, you're not really that scared anymore of what's going to happen. You're more curious to what's going to be the next effect that they pull and the next revelation that we'll get out of this thing. So there's certainly a great entertainment value in that.
I mean, I think there's something that, like I said, there's the opening with the dog. There's this notion of what, this sort of mystery of what's going on. But I think before all that, almost with the opening title card, it sort of lays it all out to you with this, like, flying saucer. I mean, it is not even sort of hiding the fact that this is the genre we're in. We're not even in Alien, where you might have a alien ship that looks realistic. This is a flying saucer, like, crashing on Earth. This is where we're at. And I think it sort of lays its card on the table, but also it just does that mood and tension really well in an entertaining way. It doesn't have... It is a similar thing to films now where they make a horror film where it's just an excuse to create a whole load of jump scares. But it avoids just being jump scares. It says, we can do better than that. We can be entertaining with something nasty that we're going to show you. We're going to be entertaining with just a general feeling that you don't know where things are going. That, like, what the nature of the thing is never quite clear. And they're sort of making assumptions with it. But then, obviously, the moment probably they thought, well, maybe the thing does that. And then someone said, but here's a cool thing we can do with it. And they said, oh, let's just scrap what we thought it could do. And it can do that as well now. This is something else it does, because this is part and parcel of making this film. And one thing I've always liked the thing for, and it always doesn't surprise me in a weird way, that it sort of failed at the box office when it came out. And it was one of those films that really built up an audience on VHS, like, people discovered it that way. And another film from a sort of similar period that the exact same thing happened to is Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. And I weirdly find these two films, like, complement each other really well. And I think one of the reasons for that is, in many ways, they're both a mess. They're both not how you would make a conventional film. Their tone is slightly all over the place. Don't think too hard about the plot, because in both cases it's not going to work. But against that, you've got a really sort of striking soundtrack. You've got moments that are sort of fantastic. You've got a sort of general inventiveness that carries you through the film. And I think both of those were qualities that were never going to go like a blockbuster opening weekend, but someone discovering it on VHS would go, oh, I enjoyed that. I'm going to tell people about that. And they both seem to have the sort of the same problem, but both be genius. And that was a way that is best discovered by VHS as the 80s progressed, that this film that sort of like mainstream critics didn't really know to some extent how to deal with it, because it doesn't tell the story in the way that you think it would. I mean, it is obviously, it's sort of a remake of a 50s B-movie. It has those trappings of a very kitsch B-movie. But then it does different things with it. It really embraces a sort of body horror element to it. It really tries to make the characters' antagonism towards each other really seem quite, like, it means something, that these are people sort of going mad under this predicament. It has all these sort of elements that almost, as with Blade Runner, the fact they don't quite cohere makes it work. It's like the sort of streamlined filmmaking would never have delivered either of these films. They come from a slightly chaotic production, and that's part of the success of it. That's part of the reason why I really like it. And, you know, they're from the same era, and they're always, to me, they're sort of weird sort of bedfellows, is Blade Runner and The Thing, as being these sort of VHS era classics, and I really enjoy it for that.
Yeah, there's a kinship there in the sense, I hope I'm not going to insult fans of these films now, but there is almost a music video vibe to it, as if it's a collage rather more. I mean, there's no logic there. It doesn't adhere to its own rules. It doesn't, you know, abide by anything except, wow, let's do this now. So it, to me, it's sort of this stream of consciousness thing. You sit down, you watch what happens, just don't try and puzzle it together, because it's no use. And it's not the point either. The plot is not the point. There's a flying saucer that crashes. Horrible things are happening in very cold weather with lots of cabin fever involved. Go. You're fine.
Yeah. I think the characters in it also you know, none of them really stands out. There's just a bunch of guys stuck in this place. And there's a lot of suspense moments that build up with the dogs and with, you know, testing the blood and going out to the shed and to the helicopter. And I think it's a stringing together of all these moments. But it's interesting for Carpenter, you know, had done Halloween and The Fog and, you know, these partly already very successful movies that he then goes to do The Thing and makes it as if it was like a very new filmmaker coming into this and kind of experimenting and maybe getting also a little bit of leeway because Halloween had been so successful. I'm not sure that he was given, you know, a bit more freedom, but maybe you know more about the circumstances.
Well, I mean, you know, the sort of special effects in this that are tremendous fun, they weren't super cheap, I think. So I think there's an element to which that these were people that had been making do for a long period of time. Suddenly had a bit more money that if they could imagine it, we can probably put it on screen. There's definitely a philosophy that this film embraces. What is this mad, crazy thing we've thought of? Let's put it on screen. And you even have the level of madness is such that even the characters in the film are reacting to it. They get to a point where they're like, I can't believe, you know, that they can't believe what they're seeing. And I think the part of it was John Carpenter had enough credit in the bank to spend money on this, to do this. And I think it sort of really, really works on that level of, you could see what he was going for. I love the music to this. I love the sort of both the Morricone and the sort of brooding John Carpenter, the score to it. It all sort of works and adds, you know, works together. And yeah, this is just a sort of entertaining horror film.
Yeah, and I always wonder, I wrote about this, I think, in earlier horror films, other horror films, but there's also some leeway that the genre itself gives you. You don't have to make, quote unquote, a serious film or whatever. The genre sort of was looked down upon a little bit and not taken too seriously. And that gave makers, especially early on, a lot of leeway also to be political about things, for instance, or to have a message in there that otherwise wouldn't have gotten past the producers. And I have a little bit of a sense of that with, I don't know if it, you know, pertains to this film, but a little bit of sense of that with The Thing, like, nobody's really looking at what we're doing. Let's have a party type deal, you know.
Well, something I think that horror films in this era do really well is the sort of idea of like, we're going to affect just a group of workers, just a group of like everyday folk, and they're not good guys. They're not moralistic. And I think the best ever team of this is in the film Alien. It'll never be top. The crew of that are just the perfect everyman crew. But I think this still has the same sort of spirit of, none of these people are good guys. None of these people are out and out good. They're all just trying to get by. And then they're suddenly put in circumstances where that's effectively impossible. The universe is too dangerous and they're screwed. And how they react to that is just a tremendously fun element of horror films. And I do think there's something that there's a weird morality that sometimes creeps into horror films, and especially in more recent decades, where the monster is ultimately going to be beaten by something that's good. The people who die will tend to be the ones, maybe they slightly deserve it. And I do like my horror to be unremittingly unfair, that there are people that are dying that don't deserve it. It's not, and I think The Omen has this. I think there's just something to it that is tremendous fun, to have a story that reminds you the world isn't fair, but does it in a fun way. And that's a good thing that horror does.
It needs to be random.
Yeah.
I think unless you're the Night of the Living Dead, and you mean something by the last death in the film, which is, I think, one of the most important horror movies ever made.
Yes.
Unless you have a really good point, I think you're right, especially with these types of things. It needs to be random. Bad stuff happens to not so much good people as ordinary people. They don't need all to be all really beautiful or anything. You don't need to do that, right? I sort of agree with you, and especially tangent, with slashers, right? The slasher genre where we all get all bad people that all die because they were adulterous or nasty or in some way sexually active, as if you are supposed to die for that. There's a reason why Halloween is such a success. Our protagonist, our final girl, is basically just an ordinary person. She's trying to survive this. And I think that's the strength of that one as well. So yeah, I agree with you.
I mean, I just sort of thinking about how this is sort of like a fun horror film, and we've talked about, like, you know, the sort of ghost story films and stuff like that of yesteryear, but, you know, this is our Halloween podcast. So in terms of general horror films, have any of you seen any horror films recently that you would recommend for this spooky season? Starting with you, Sam.
I thought of two that I saw within the last, you know, half year. I mean, one was Heretic, with Hugh Grant as this, you know, actor that we don't associate with horror, but then he's this man that is visited by two Mormon girls who try to convince him, and he lets them into the house, and at first everything seems like harmless, but then something is very off, and it's one of the films where, you know, a house again plays a big role, and being drawn into the both the space but also the mindset of a character you cannot trust. And I think it's a great setup. However, I was then kind of disappointed by what happens in the, you know, in the second half. But I remember seeing the trailer and I thought, this is such a great idea, such a moody, atmospheric, unexpected twist on the persona that we associate with Hugh Grant. And then the second one is one with The, and it was The Substance.
Oh yeah,
which I thought was just like a fantastic, you know, twist on the body horror, extending it into something completely different, talking about really relevant topics around Hollywood and beauty standard and aging. Demi Moore, obviously, in such a lauded role. And, you know, even though it was almost unbearable for me to watch it at the cinema, it really was one of those films that made me physically very sick to begin with. I was glad that I didn't leave the theater and stayed, because it was just a mind-blowing experience. Not only, you know, I mean, it's definitely not to everybody's taste, but it was worth staying until the end because it was relevant body horror. And that's something to say. And I really, really enjoyed it for that. So those were the two, I think, both very interesting, one very successful examples that I thought of.
What about you, Julie? Have you seen any horror films recently you'd recommend?
I'm going to make you all cry. So I already talked about this one. I keep banging the drum about The Devil's Backbone, which is part of a two-parter, in a sense, with Pan's Labyrinth. We already discussed this. Franco Spain, it addresses that very directly. But The Devil's Backbone is sometimes a little bit the forgotten one of the pair. But I think it's one of the best treatments of the ghost story and what it tells you. I recommend everybody sees it, but it's going to break your heart. It's not a horror film in the sense that there is a lot of effects. Again, this is not Martyr, where people get flayed all over the place, right? This is one of those quiet ones where you just have to sit down, pay attention, and it'll break your heart. I'm also going to bang the drum a little bit about some of the really classics. The Fly, go see the old one with Jeff Goldblum. That's so fabulous, you know? And again, Alien, my favorite final girl in all the world. So don't forget the classics. I thought The Substance went a little bit nuts, Sam.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit nuts. And of course, if you don't want to have your heart broken, go for a little bit of a slasher, like classics like Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween, and, you know, have a little fun out there, get out the popcorn. But for me, I think I like all of those. But for today, I sort of thought The Devil's Backbone, I so nearly used that for this podcast. I shied away from it a little bit, but do go see it, because it's beyond fabulous, I think, and very, very relentless.
We'll save it for another one. There's a lot to talk about it. I was going to sort of quickly mention The Substance, because I did enjoy that. I even have a soft spot for how ridiculous it gets. I think there's something incredibly brave that it sort of embraces the madness and goes so far. I don't know whether that's going to stand up so well on rewatches, but in the cinema, I loved it for that. I was just going to think that I've been watching quite a few of the sort of recent horror films. There's been quite a few good ones this year. And what's been quite interesting is that if you sort of take horror films to be on a bit of a spectrum these days, which on one side is sort of out and out quite body horror, they're sort of genuinely quite unsettling. And on the other side, almost something comic, something sort of more fun. And the sort of three films that I've seen this year sort of straddle that quite nicely. So on the very sort of extreme end, there was a film called Bring Her Back with Sally Hawkins as this sort of desperate mother who obviously, Bring Her Back is related to a lost daughter. And that is a gut punch of a film, but not emotionally, just viscerally. it is genuinely something that I don't feel I'd warn many people about horror films, but that one beforehand going in is there are moments that are just there because you think the makers thought this is going to make a whole cinema just go. And it does that brilliantly, but like be warned that it's that kind of film and it doesn't really let off. And then on the other sort of extreme that is almost, oh, this is like fun, is the film Weapons that has come out, which really I think it's almost like a Steven Spielberg film set in small town America. I think Stephen King at his most friendly is sort of part of it. It's about sort of one night in the small American town, all the kids in a classroom just disappear. They get up, they run out the bed at the same time, they run into the night and no one knows where they are. And so what is the mystery of this? And it has moments that are clearly sort of has the cinema gasping. They clearly know that, you know, you've got to deliver certain things for a modern horror audience. But it ultimately is just quite a fun story. It's got quite a fun antagonist to it. It's nicely broke down how they tell the story. The guy who wrote it said he was very influenced by Magnolia, which seems like a very odd thing to cite in a horror film. But when you watch it, you see exactly where he's coming from with that. But it is very sort of undemanding fun there. And then in between the two, something that sort of had its share of body horror, but also I think just its share of fun, was the horror film Together as another more recent one, which is sort of a couple. They move into a new house and then maybe something weird is connecting them both physically, viscerally, and as things sort of what is going on. And that sort of builds up quite nicely, but it all sort of fits into this spectrum that you're either having fun because it's quite mainstream entertaining, or you're having fun because it's absolutely grisly and in your face. And that seems to be a lot of horror these days, but they fit nicely on this spectrum. I would recommend all three for different reasons.
No shortage of horror film for sure. You know, I'm also thinking of the success that Sinners was this year, or 28 Years Later just came out, or Nosferatu was remade. So, I mean, we could talk about that endlessly. Every era had its share of interesting horror films, but this point in time right now, I think, is also ripe for a lot of, you know, present and future horror, I'm sure.
It's always talked about that when cinema needs it as a medium, it's sort of horror films that deliver audiences. I think that is, I think, one of the most purest experiences that make people go to the cinema is the cinematic experience of horror. And I think especially with the way that I think, you know, comedies, people think, I'll watch that at home. I don't need to see that in the cinema. The box office related to horror, you know, horror fans keep cinema going. I think it was a case in the 50s. There was a lot that, you know, horror really helped. I think we talked about 70s horror. That was another big blockbuster way of horror fans will turn up in cinemas to watch films. And I think right at this moment in time, I think it's horror that's doing a lot of the running when it comes to keeping cinema going. And there are the films that warrant it as well. They warrant seeing. It's worth it. There's a lot of invention out there in current horror. So yeah, a lot of recommendations. But also, yeah, sometimes go back to the classics. So thank you for joining me to discuss all the definitive horror films that we could think of. And join us next time for another damn fine cup of culture. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.